Welcome to the China Meetup Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Fulton, a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlanta Council and a political scientist at Zayed University in Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates. China's Navy has made significant strides this century, growing in both size and capabilities. It now has the world's largest naval fleet with over 340 warships, and this increasing capacity signals to many that China's maritime ambitions are to sustain global reach. At the same time, its power projection seems modest relative to its size, and it currently has a single overseas naval base, the People's Liberation Army Supply Base in Djibouti, which opened in 2017. This base drew a lot of international attention during the Red Sea crisis as the Houthis disrupted maritime shipping that passes through two vital choke points, Bab el-Mandeb and the Suez Canal. There is an expectation that the People's Liberation Army Navy could or should do more to protect these important shipping lanes. That it didn't leads to questions about what kind of role we can expect China to play as a maritime security actor. To answer some of these questions, I'm very happy to be talking with Dr. Isaac Carden. Isaac is a senior fellow for China Studies at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and he's also an adjunct professor at Johns Hopkins. His research centers on China's maritime power with specialization in maritime disputes and the international law of the sea, PRC global port development, PLA overseas basing, and China-Pakistan relations. He is also the author of a recent book that's been getting great reviews, China's Law of the Sea, The New Rules of Maritime Order, which was published with Yale University Press last year. Isaac, welcome to the show.
Jonathan, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, you've been on the list for a long time, and recent events make your research focus very, very timely. So great to have you.
Well, yeah, interested to dig into those questions you've raised.
Okay, well, let's get right into it then, and we can start promoting your book right out of the gate. So, and feel free to be shameless in promoting your book. You know, that's what it's there for. So your book talks about the
geopolitics. Don't tempt me.
Yeah. Academic. It's occupational hazard for all of us, I think. So your book talks about the geopolitics of China's maritime disputes and asks whether China's trying to challenge the global order. And what's great about it is you've got a very interesting case. You're using the international law of the sea as a case study. Can you briefly give us an overview? What is China's law of the sea?
Well, the first thing to say is it's a long and detailed book, so definitely do pick it up. So the basic motivation for this, as you rightly observed, is to look at the law of the sea as an instance of China's relationship to international order. And there are a lot of reasons why I think the law of the sea is really one of the most important, if not necessarily the most representative place to look at the nature of China's relationship to order. And what China's law of the sea is basically a detailed study of the ways that China has tried to develop and use certain rules to advance its maritime interests. And so it's very much a story about its relationship to the international legal system and the rules that compose it. And I get to this kind of really literal-minded focus on rules, specific rules of the law of the sea, particularly those enshrined in the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, UNCLOS, the biggest multilateral treaty in the international system other than the UN Charter itself. And the reason I'm so literal-minded about it is that basically any conception of order that we can come up with, whether from an extreme kind of realpolitik standpoint, where rules and law are really just a reflection of hegemonic power in a system, or from a more liberal frame of mind where rules actually constitute and build up the structure of the system. In either event, we're going to be interested in rules, and I'd argue we're going to be interested in rules of international law as the most concrete types of rules and norms in the system. And the law of the sea is really encompassing some of the most significant disputes and conflicts and international security problems that China confronts. If we look across its periphery, we see that it's remarkably settled most of its land boundary disputes over the course of its short history, with the sole exception of India and Bhutan, which are not trivially in the least, but are reflective of a general pacification of that frontier. Whereas when we look at the maritime domain, every single boundary that China could have in its maritime space is disputed. That's a function of sovereignty disputes. It's a function of, in my view, their way of understanding and using the law, which I call China's law of the sea.
Cool. So, you know, when we're talking about order, and this is something I think all of us, if you're doing IR, if you're doing security studies, international order has gone from being kind of an abstraction to something that is really, really concrete, I think, in the way we look at how things are shifting right now. So what capacity does China have to challenge international maritime order? And what does that look like in the coming years?
So the short answer is China has great and growing capacity. I'll note that the original title that I was working with for this book was Rising Power, Creeping Jurisdiction. And there's very much a direct relationship between how much capacity China has in particular to enforce its domestic maritime law with law enforcement capacity and its ability to change rules. Now, I'll give away a kind of some of the conclusions of the study, which I didn't get into its empirical details, but I'm really asking, because of this frustration with order as such a nebulous concept, trying to focus in on this concrete set of questions. And so I look at individual rules, to my estimate, all of the specific rules that China really has a dispute, an international dispute with either neighbors or extra-regional powers like the United States about. And I try and assess, according to the same standard, are they doing the things that under international law, under a basic interpretation of international law, meet some necessary threshold where they could be changing the rules? And the short answer is, in most cases, the answer is no. And the reason is other countries don't much like what China's doing in this space. And it does take some acquiescence at a minimum, if not acceptance, for practices, the activities of a powerful state, to really start to be codified or recognized as norms. What we see is more that China is not changing the rules themselves so much as it's changing the environment in which those rules might actually bear on state behavior. And overall, I would say it's making the rules less effective is sort of the upshot of the study. International law from a Chinese perspective is an important part of international order. When you hear their officials, to include the senior most leadership, talk about international order and international law, we often hear this discussion about the UN-centric international system. And I think we can afford to take them at their word in at least one significant way here, which is that they're very focused on challenging the system from within its basic institutional framework. The United Nations system doesn't necessarily entail that many substantive norms as far as China's maritime disputes are concerned, but it means one big thing, and it is sovereignty is going to be the core consideration in any of these disputes. And that's what we see as far as a potential challenge to international maritime order that I think we can start to track empirically, is just how much control the coastal states have over maritime space that they claim. Just how much can they creep their jurisdiction out into maritime space? And I'd say even more specifically, it's just how much can China do it? Because what they're doing is not going to be replicated elsewhere. There's nobody with, I believe the U.S. National Security Strategy talks about sort of the combination of power and intent, and recognizing China as the only power that has those requisite levels of capability and intent. And I think the problem that China runs into, as I foreshadowed, is that they are not meeting a very receptive international audience when it comes to their maritime disputes, because in each of those cases, there's some other aggrieved party with some other version of the rules. And now we sort of come to the question, and I suppose I'll leave off here because we can talk about it in its concrete forms, of what's that interaction like between power and the rules? And what we see is generally that China has made the rules less effective in maritime East Asia. It's very difficult for you to enforce your rights under the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea if you're Vietnam, if you're the Philippines, if you're Malaysia, if you're Brunei, if you're Japan, in many cases, the power differentials have come to matter significantly. They've made your ability to have recourse to international law as a regional actor in particular, less effective, more dilute.
So that's really interesting, because when you're talking about that, I mean, when you say countries like, you know, Malaysia, Indonesia, even Japan, of course, you know, that asymmetry works in China's favor, but it doesn't work in China's favor when it's everybody, right? Like when they're antagonizing every country in their region, or if every country feels that China's actions are threatening their sovereignty in the maritime domain, which leads to a whole lot of other issues in terms of just hard security and trade and investment development and everything. So, I mean, doesn't this seem somewhat short-sighted on China's side, you know, by trying to push up against the rules of the, you know, the so-called rules of the order? They're actually putting themselves in a less secure spot because they're not only pushing against the U.S. and its allies and partners, but also against all of its neighbors, making its potential to kind of expand its presence beyond the region that much harder.
Yeah, and you know, this is a pattern that we've seen for a long time. I think the negative reactions of the region or of other claimants have been pretty plain to see, and you'd think also for Chinese leadership for all this time. But I think ultimately it forces us to ask the question of why have they persisted in this assertiveness, was the original kind of meme about how to understand this. Why is it that in this particular area of its foreign policy, even in sort of at the tail end of what they used to call China's charm offensive in Southeast Asia in particular, why did they just remove the charm and it became offensive? They started being very assertive with fishing vessels, for example, from Vietnam that had historically fished on the west and east side of the Median Line, started kidnapping and arresting them, started pushing the Filipinos around much harder, started ultimately a few years later building up artificial island bases and facilities to support this Coast Guard and potentially naval and other military presence. And I think the reason that they've been willing to pay these costs has to do with a sense of sovereignty being their most core interest. As I was saying before, what can we really pull out? And, you know, having had the chance to reflect a little bit on not just the law of the sea, but a bunch of different regimes, now that the book is safely behind me and used to be off camera, what we can say is that whatever else China thinks of it as its international priorities, the protection of its sovereign integrity and the sort of the political security and stability of the Central Party regime being intimately linked to this sense of the sovereign unity of China, which includes, of course, Taiwan and their conception of it. You can start to understand why these maritime issues, of which Taiwan is, of course, one. It is one not unlike the South China Sea Islands and emphatically not unlike the East China Sea Islands. It is part of the same end of World War II in which Japan surrendered these territories effectively into the ether, not to one or the other China, not to any of the other claimants, but rather simply surrendered them because of these sovereignty issues. Understanding why China is so fixated on these sovereignty issues, and in particular the question of Taiwan, is well beyond our scope here. But I think for me, it explains why actions that appear counterproductive, that appear to run against China's interest, if we were to take them again at their word that they care about the law of the sea and want to advance the progressive development of international law and make the UN the centerpiece of the international system. I think those things are all of a piece with this sense from China that its most core interest in its sovereign integrity is challenged in this case, and it's willing to accept quite a lot of cost for it. And if we listen to how they project out the evolution of the international system, maybe we can see why. This idea that we're already in a multipolar world, rather than it's sort of on its way. We're starting to hear from senior diplomats and from Xi Jinping himself, this idea that multipolarity is not this projected future state, but rather we're in that circumstance now. And I think roughly what that means from the standpoint of the international legal system is something recognizable to an older generation of international relations scholars as like spheres of influence. And again, when I think about where does China have the capacity to challenge maritime order, I think it's really concentrated in East Asia. And I know you want to pull us out and start talking about other regions, and it'll be interesting to make that contrast explicit as we do that. Those other regions are areas in which I wouldn't say China is indifferent to international law. They certainly are focused on their overseas interests, but there's no direct bearing on Chinese sovereignty. There is no need for China to focus on international legal conflict as a centerpiece of its problems. And so we see an entirely different set of priorities. I think unfortunately for the region in particular, where there's many aggrieved states who don't get to have an exclusive economic zone, don't get to enjoy the resources that they're entitled to under international law, I think unfortunately for them, that power dynamic, as my colleague and mentor Peter Dutton has referred to, this sort of balance between power and institutional mechanisms in international order, that's something that they just have to contend with on a daily and practical basis. And the fact of China's extraordinary Coast Guard capacity, fisheries capacity, not to mention naval capacity, which we'll start to talk about, makes international law much less effective in that maritime littoral there in East Asia.
Yeah. So when you talk about core interests, and it just made me think of Susan Shirk's book from last year, I guess, Overreach. And she writes about how, you know, you mentioned that period of the new assertiveness. And, you know, right around the later years of the second Hu Jintao administration, she writes about how the South China Sea evolved as one of the core interests, which previously were all very domestic, right? And now she's saying there's this more expansionist view of it. And if you were in Southeast Asia, you would have felt that because there was that ASEAN summit, in 2010, when Yang Jiechi kind of let the quiet part out. He said, you know, we're a big state and you're small states and you just have to accept this. And it's interesting because I think I agree completely with you, your assertion that East Asia is where this is more tangible and this is where it matters most to China. But of course, you know, where I am in the Gulf region, a lot of those countries that are affected by this are very important customers and investment partners for Gulf countries. A lot of the shipping that goes both directions is affected by that, right? It passes through the South China Sea. So, you know, it's hard to look at this and say, well, this is a regional issue because it has spillover effects that really just go across the entire IOR and lands right here eventually, which is a great segue, I think, to, you know, bringing the Middle East into this.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we don't see, you know, a lot of Chinese naval presence here. There's the plan supply base in Djibouti. This has been used in support of the anti-piracy mission since, you know, since 2017, but they've been here since, I believe, 2008. There's been a lot of port of calls in Oman and in the Emirates. There's been joint naval drills with the Saudis and the Iranians. But beyond that, there hasn't really been a whole lot, you know. So do you anticipate that's going to change? Can we expect to see the People Liberation Army, Navy playing a bigger role in the Middle Eastern affairs?
So this is a really important question about, you know, what sort of an international order we're likely to have. And I wish I had a crystal ball to say exactly what the sort of planning parameters are for, let's say, particularly the People's Liberation Army. But I think you can say with confidence it is going to change, especially in the Middle East region, because as you rightly note, that Indian Ocean kind of trunk line connecting Chinese population centers in the east coast of China to oil and gas in the Middle East, to minerals, to markets in Europe, to all of the sort of essential lifeblood of their economic system, has already driven a lot of PLA deployments. You mentioned the base at Djibouti. That is very much sort of the western end of this chain, and what we've seen across the rest of the expanse of the Indian Ocean is a variety of commercial facilities that the PLA has made increasingly intensive use of just to sustain its deployments across the Indian Ocean region. So there's no reason to expect that particular trend is not going to continue to grow. They started sailing into the Indian Ocean region in 1985, making visits to some of their friends in Bangladesh and Pakistan in particular. And basically it's a secular, linear trend all the way up to now. The question is, what are some of those considerations that might bend that curve and might either accelerate or perhaps decelerate this process? And I think, unfortunately, the extraordinary turmoil in the Red Sea now and in the region generally is not something that the PLA or that Chinese civilian strategic thinkers look at as being a sustainable situation over the long term. Because it is China disproportionately that relies on these trade flows moving east and west across this lane, the idea that there's going to be some permanent kind of obstacle or separation in it might be manageable from the standpoint of shipping taking the long way around. We haven't stopped up any of the one-way maritime choke points like Hormuz, for example. But those are some of the things where you'd say China does have this latent capability. They do have a light basing footprint, but also quite a formidable blue water navy, an ability to sustain forces on station in places like the Gulf of Aden or potentially in the Persian Gulf or Arabian Gulf, as your preference dictates. And yet the questions for them are, why do it if the United States is committed to free navigation as one of its core interests? You know, if we think about what are some of the parallels to China's designation of sovereignty over islands to include some things that really don't belong in the same sentence as, you know, say Taiwan, which is also a question of sovereignty. The United States, I think, also has a similar big expansive category of a core interest that has to do with free navigation. And China can really bank on that in a lot of respects. We've shown a credible commitment to pay significant costs, both in terms of lives and materiel, but also it's probably diplomatic costs and reputational costs of fighting against Houthi rebels who are interfering with free navigation and not having much to show for it in terms of protecting that commercial flows that we're hoping to see. And so I think, again, China is quite confident that the United States is going to remain committed to it. And so I think that's put them in a situation where they're just going to exploit their particular short-term advantages in this situation, the fact that they're not being directly targeted. But over the long term, they're watching themselves become more and more dependent on a set of U.S. core interests in free navigation that the United States might not be able to uphold and certainly might not be willing over time. And I guess the last thing to say is if we tack back to this idea that China believes we are in a multipolar world, and in particular, what that means is the United States has declined relatively, will continue to decline. We hear the East is rising and the West is falling. If that's the case, this seems strategically quite unsound, unless China thinks free navigation is maybe not so essential to its economic model. But we don't, that's one of the things that could bend the curve too. But what we see, in fact, is increasing dependence on oil imported from the Middle East. Every year that ticks up, and somehow, even as China pursues these more, say, high-minded economic development goals, what we see is great intensity of its dependence on imported commodities, especially this oil and gas coming from the region. And so, yeah, I think just to sum it all up, we should certainly expect it to change. And I think it's going to be really contingency-based whether or not you see a more assertive set of actions on the part of the PLA. But I feel pretty confident in saying unless and until there is some major acute blockage and risk to individual Chinese vessels, assets, citizens, this idea of Chinese overseas interests, I think we're just watching more of a gradual process of building capacity, building confidence, building a network of dual-use commercial facilities that can sustain some level of military presence, but nothing intended to replicate, say, the footprint of CENTCOM in the region. There's no trajectory that we're watching now by which a series of marginal changes to China's posture is going to produce that. That's something that requires a major discontinuity, some major rupture in the system. And I think I won't speculate on that other than to say that sort of geopolitical conflict appears more probable now than it did, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, I think from the standpoint of Chinese analysts as well. It's not just in your region or in Washington where we're feeling that kind of disorder and instability. And so with that in mind, I think there's a lot more potential for China to revisit some of its assumptions about, well, what is the nature of the military capability that we need to have out of area? What do we need to do to protect our overseas interests in an environment where the United States is less capable and perhaps less interested in providing this public good of free navigation, if they can even do it, which I think has got to be a serious question in Beijing.
Yeah, you know, I keep thinking about, I've been reading a lot of Chinese analysts talking about what the current, you know, situation in the Middle East says about, you know, it's always framed as a response to U.S. hegemony. And there seems to be a very triumphalist, you know, it's over and now we're entering this new order, this new multipolarity that you're describing. And I keep thinking, okay, well, I don't know if I buy that yet, but even if I do, you should be careful what you wish for, you know, because it's not like it's going to be, hey, the U.S. is out and it's an easy march for China to just increase its capacity. Because as you just described a few minutes ago, it's been antagonizing a lot of pretty powerful Asian powers, you know, Japan, Australia, India, Korea. They're making their own neighborhood a lot more competitive too. So it's not like it's going to be an easy waltz out of the South China Sea or the East China Sea to global domination, because they've really made their own strategic landscape a lot more complicated than I think they had to. I want to come back to what you were talking about with these commercial ports in a couple of minutes, because I think this is a really interesting thing that doesn't get talked about a lot. But before I do, I just got to talk a little, or I've got to ask you a little bit about this base in Djibouti, because sure. It really seems to confound a lot of people, you know, especially with the attacks on Red Sea shipping. Everybody kept saying, look, China's got warships in the Red Sea. Why aren't they doing something? And there seems to be this expectation that, you know, this is a facility that China could use to project power in a region where they have a lot of interest, a lot of assets, a lot of expat citizens. Why didn't they do it? So just what's your take? How does this base feature in China's regional maritime strategy? Does it represent a challenge to the interests of the U.S. and America's allies in the region?
Well, I guess first of all, thanks for the good focus question. I think that facility, Djibouti, is really important. And going from zero overseas bases to one is a really fundamental qualitative change in Chinese foreign policy. And I think maybe that's been lost over the last 7 years, that is really quite remarkable. And you have to think that going from one to two or more is a much easier political feat. It really required a major change in orientation. As to why they're standing idly by in the midst of a protracted crisis that does challenge Chinese interests in the region, is on the first thing to say is the naval escort task forces that have been out in Aden from the Chinese PLA naval escort task forces that have been operating in and around the Gulf of Aden and using the facility at Djibouti since 2008 are still on site. And if you look at some of the Chinese ship owners' websites, which I'm sure most people don't, you'll see they're still running the same tracks that they have done in the Gulf of Aden it's sort of a standardized operational pattern where they're in communication, in particular with Chinese shipping. But they're not involved in trying to intercept any rockets or drones, of course. They're certainly not taking the fight to the Houthis in Yemen by any stretch of the imagination. They're sitting on the sidelines and criticizing the Americans for being responsible for the Houthi aggression in some way. So the short and kind of dirty explanation for why that is, of course, Chinese shipping's not being targeted. We don't want to miss that. I don't want to be misconstrued as saying that there's not some short-term benefit for China in all of this. They are exploiting the short-term benefit of other countries not being willing to push their flag shipping through a channel that now has very costly war insurance risk, and that now the cost to the cost of your container has quintupled, I think, as of February. We can double check. There's been a lot of flux in the system, but basically they don't perceive an acute threat to Chinese personnel, Chinese assets, this sort of narrowly circumscribed set of things that are Chinese overseas interests. So I think that, that goes a long way towards why have they not moved to action. Another thing to say is, and this gets to the history of the Djibouti base, is it took a lot of stars aligning for the decision in Beijing to be reached that they were going to go from zero to one, that you're going to radically transform this seemingly ideological stance against something like overseas bases. They certainly got a lot of mileage out of criticizing Americans and Europeans and others for availing themselves of these overseas basing opportunities. But one of the big reasons that they were able to sort of clear some of those blockages was that there was a UN resolution authorizing this counter-piracy action in Yemen that, back to this discussion of what do they think of as being the core ordering institutions, it's basically a dilute UN that does very little, but the few things it does will certainly reflect at a minimum a member of the UN Security Council's view of what is necessary in the international security environment. And so they have, I'd say, a very high threshold for what would lead them to be involved in a multinational, multilateral security effort like the United States is trying to lead in the Red Sea region. Those stars might well align under some circumstances. You could envision this crisis in the Red Sea protracting over weeks and months and ultimately causing even more severe disruptions that would create the conditions under which you would have something like a UN authorized I don't know what you would describe the campaign as being. It's hard to imagine UN authorizing any attacks on targets in Yemen, for example. But you could imagine China being much more involved in some sort of escort or convoy operation, for example. I think I would say actually that UN authorization might be pretty close to a necessary condition for that. I don't think under the current circumstances that absence of radical change to Houthis beginning to really target Chinese vessels or Chinese infrastructure in Saudi or in the UAE or elsewhere as they have done in the past, or the Yanbu refinery in Saudi, for example. You could think of a couple things where China would say, aha, that's a real, that really hurts. That's an overseas interest. We need to show why we have military capacity in this region to begin with. There'll be some demand for it from back home, and I would also think from the region. And I'm actually curious your sense of how this is perceived in the region. To me, reputationally, it can't really redound to China's kind of prestige in the region as a major security player or as a potential balancer of American power in the region for them to be pretty passive, but I'm also pretty naive of much knowledge about how regional actors in the Middle East, North Africa think about anything. So I'm curious if that's a reasonable assessment from your perspective.
I think that's fair. Everything from December 22 when Xi Jinping went to Riyadh for that series of summits, and then he welcomed President Raisi of Iran 2 months later, and then they had, of course, the rapprochement between the Saudis and the Iranians and the expansion of BRICS and Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and, had Prime Minister or President Abbas visit, and, all of this activity that created an impression of China playing a bigger role you know, as there's always been that knock, right? You're focused on economic stuff. We need more than that from a great power. We need political and security support. And it seemed, I think, to a lot of people here that was the signal we were getting. You know, everybody kept contrasting Xi's visit with President Biden's visit, you know, a few months earlier, and saying, you know, this is evidence of a shift. I think, and this is speculation, but just talking to people around the region, their interests, you know, everything that they were trying to do before October 7th was focusing on de-escalating regional tensions to draw in FDI, to draw in international companies that can help them achieve their development agendas. And a big part of that was dealing with the war in Yemen. So when the Houthis start to, you know, destabilize again in the Red Sea, I think there's an expectation from a lot of regional actors that important extra-regional partners are going to help them. And when China basically said, well, you're not hitting us, I think that was probably disappointing. I don't know if disappointing is the word, but I think it was just this realization that, hey, maybe we shouldn't expect, maybe we're projecting what we think a great power should look like onto China, and maybe that's just not who China is. So I think I agree with you. I think it does actually speak volumes, you know, about what kind of power we can expect it to be around here.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that perspective. And I think this idea that China is ipso facto a substitute for the United States as a security player in the region has been sort of resoundingly defeated in reality. That's not something that China aspires to do. That's not something that they're postured to do. And I think the quicker the region can readjust their expectations about what China is likely to do, I think the happier we'll all be, probably.
Absolutely agree. So coming back to these commercial ports and industrial parks, this is something, you know, there's this never-ending rumor about what China's doing in the Abu Dhabi port here, Khalifa Port, KIZAD. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of folks have a hard time accepting that these are primarily commercial. There's an expectation they're going to be dual purpose. But I think also, you could see a few years ago, I think it was in 2018, there was a China-Arab States Cooperation Forum, and Foreign Minister Wang Yi rolled out this wonderfully titled initiative called the Industrial Park Port Connectivity Two-Wheel, Two-Wing Approach. It rolls off the tongue. And it was interesting for folks here because you could see there had been a lot of investment into KIZAD in Abu Dhabi. There had been investment into Dhukhman Awan, industrial park in Saudi, and the facility in Djibouti, and a couple of ports and parks in Egypt, and of course in Haifa and in Gwadar. And what you start to see was what looked like a series of unconnected projects were starting to look like kind of a connective tissue, you know, that were kind of bridging Chinese interests across the region and getting you into the Med, where, of course, you know, you being the biggest trading partner. You've written a really great article, I believe, with Security Studies last year, right? Or was it the year before on China's ports?
I've got one in international security called Peer Competitor that really kind of details the whole portfolio, to add another pun into the mix, if that's okay.
Nice. But yeah, so I mean, so if you're sitting here in the Middle East and you look at this and you think, well, this is an unusual configuration that's used to, like you said, we're used to bases. We're used to Turkey, mm-hmm. France, and the UK and the US with military hardware. And then China comes in with ports and industrial parks. Is this consistent, you know, from your research about looking at China's, you know, portfolio, which is wonderful. Mm-hmm. You know, is that kind of the approach?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's nested in the discussion we were just having about not expecting to see the, you know, traditional military forward great power, to the extent that is even a traditional pattern. It's at least that's the prevailing norm from the 20th century, and what we're seeing from China in the 21st is, first and foremost, is that their economic motivations are the primary ones, and the security ones are derivative of that. I think, again, they've put their money where their mouth is. China is the only power that is developing from soup to nuts these industrial park type projects. There's nobody who does it at this scale. And as you rightly note, there's a network effect that arises from. And that's really what that piece is about, is saying, you know, the individual ports are very interesting, but what we want to look at is what is China's position in this network get for it from a security standpoint? And the basic logic of it is that China is primarily focused on its economic development, and that's why it's invested so heavily in so much of this transportation infrastructure, because of course China is a highly trade dependent economy. It's the biggest trading nation in the world, and in particular, as I said, commodity imports going across the Indian Ocean, whether it's oil and gas or minerals or ag or any number of other things that are essential, that's the strategic object. And so then the question is, what are we going to do under this international system, not some, you know, historical one that has led other great powers to do other things? What is China meant to do under this system, in which there's probably not a lot of scope for China to develop an overseas basing network that rivals the United States? The historical particularities by which that particular capacity developed are not going to be replicated by China under the current system. And I think what we've seen is they've been arguably the biggest beneficiary of the open, globalized, liberal trading and monetary and investment system that's evolved over the course of the post-war period, and that appears to be facing some profound strains now. And therefore, what they need to do is continue to exploit that and then figure out, well, what's the level of security that we need to protect our discrete overseas interests? And I think that's really that's the framing that makes observations about what they're doing make the most sense to me. It's that these economic assets now generate significant security risk. As you'll well know, Chinese workers are subject to attacks and kidnapping, and Chinese assets have been destroyed or seized at huge scale. For example, in Libya in 2011, you know, you hear a lot about the loss of life and the horrible war and civil war that ensued. But in China, mostly you hear about $20 billion of investment that got flushed down the toilet. And those are the sorts of things that I think have made this portfolio of infrastructure assets look so important to military planners and to people in Beijing and the party state who are tasked with thinking holistically about China's national security. And I think if we take seriously what they say about how are they oriented with respect to national security, Xi Jinping's holistic national security concept, or comprehensive national security concept, describes security as the prerequisite for development. That's sort of a new gloss on a relationship that used to be a little more balanced. It now clearly puts security in front. And I think we see exactly that movement going on in China's overseas assets, where you say, yes, the initial impulse is economic development. It's quite logical that China is willing to maybe take some quarterly losses investing in assets that don't smell so good to U.S. private equity firms, for example, because they have this strategic interest in having high levels of connectivity and high levels of control over their own flows of critical minerals, oil, gas, et cetera. Just how militarized they can get is part of the question that we're asking. And if I haven't been clear on it, I'll try and emphasize it again. I don't anticipate that these are becoming bases on the order of, you know, sort of the dedicated facilities that we're familiar with from a U.S. perspective, a Yokosuka or Manama in Bahrain, right? This is not where those are trending. And if you're trying to look at indicators and warnings about those developing, I think you're going to miss the boat. It's more like, what are the missions that now exist as a result of these overseas interests being so widely distributed and growing? What is that mission set? And then what is the potential support available to them in that particular region? And I think when we start to think about cobbling together the different capacities that China can get from these many facilities, whether at Khalifa or Gwadar, if you're there in the Gulf, or further up in Kuwait and Iraq, where we've also seen a lot more construction activity and not as much operations from China. And you basically see if what they want to do is have some naval capability on station, be able to sustain its logistics, be able to collect some intelligence, be able to do perhaps some limited escort convoy in a pinch. Those are the sorts of capabilities that you can reasonably expect to get out of commercial facilities. And those are just about the highest end of military activities that we could envision under the current circumstances. Again, I'll tack back. You were asking about, you know, what should we expect to see change? And I ended up really coming down on it's going to be contingency based. That's weaseling out of the question in a way, but unless there's some major breach, you would expect them to continue to muddle through along the path we're going, which is to say they'll get gradually, marginally more military utility out of various commercial facilities. I think the one at Khalifa has a particularly high upside because they're trying to negotiate for actual honest to goodness PLA access. I don't think that's the case across the board in some of these other facilities, but what they get out of them are the same things that the US Navy or any other global Navy gets out of commercial facilities. Resupply, replenishment, liberty for the sailors aboard, ability to swap crews, ability to do some limited repairs. And I guess I'll close by noting we do see less limited repairs going on at some of the Chinese facilities. The idea of conducting a technical stop is something that PLA sources reported on in at least 9 occasions over the last 10 years, where they said this call at a commercial port was something significantly more than just resupplying and refueling. We don't have the exquisite details of whether they did a full overhaul on a naval vessel. It seems unlikely, but at least some maintenance, perhaps installing some specialized parts. And so what we're seeing is, again, a gradual, cautious expansion of the range of things that Chinese military forces are going to be able to do operating out of area, but still quite modest relative to, again, the capacity and capability that a CENTCOM brings to bear. There's not really a pathway towards that I can envision.
Isaac, this has been really great, man. I think a lot of people in the region who have, like I said, there's been a lot more questions than answers lately, and I think this will go a long way to helping people try to work our way through some of it, because it's been a confounding period. And, I think that's probably true right across the map. But here especially, it's been pretty tense lately and a lot of questions. And so this is very helpful. Thanks a lot, man.
Well, consider me confounded too, but I hope I've been able to at least provide some food for thought. And yeah, really appreciate your insights and the opportunity to join you, Jonathan. This is really fascinating.
Excellent. Thanks a lot. To our listeners, thanks for joining us again. And we've got another great show lined up pretty soon. So stick around and make sure you like and rate and subscribe and all that good podcast stuff. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thank you very much.